WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
William Finnegan has covered South Africa from a perspective usually closed off to white American journalists. He traveled through black townships with black South African reporters during 6 weeks of the summer of 1986. Just a few days after he arrived in South Africa, the government declared a state of emergency. It effectively restricted the press coverage of unrest to items released by the Bureau of Information in Pretoria. The black reporters Finnegan traveled with worked for the white liberal paper, the Johannesburg Star. The position of the reporters struck Finnegan as extraordinarily complex, caught between the conflicting forces of the police, the editors, the paper's owners, and the black community. Finnegan reported on the South African press for the New Yorker magazine, where he's a staff writer. He expanded the story into the new book, Dateline Soweto. Finnegan told me why he wanted to travel with black reporters in South Africa.
Well, I had spent some time in South Africa before. I'd worked for a year teaching in a black high school in Cape Town and written a book about that experience, and then went around speaking to groups in the U.S. about South Africa, and was struck by how many people had been surprised to read my description of the opposition press in South Africa. Americans, some, seemed surprised to hear that there is an opposition press in South Africa. People seemed particularly intrigued by stories I told about a friend who is a black reporter in Cape Town. And so when I wanted to go back to South Africa and was looking for a specific story to tell, it was an obvious choice, particularly black reporters on a white liberal paper, I thought, besides having a ringside view of what's going on in the country, really catch it from all sides, from their editors and indirectly the owners of the papers, from the police, of course, and from the black communities they work in.
Well, it's very hard for a white reporter to travel with a black reporter into the black areas, but it was especially hard because when you were there, there was a state of emergency declared. Did that make it exceptionally difficult for you to get to where you wanted to go?
It did make my job a little harder. It really changed the job of really all reporters in South Africa, but particularly the black reporters. The staple of their work, which would be, you know, political marches, political meetings, political funerals, strikes, boycotts, and so on, that was just cleared away. And
this is stuff you were no longer allowed to cover.
Well, the things themselves stopped happening.
Mm-hmm.
Mid-June 1986. I mean, those, you know, political meetings, political funerals, those are the places where very often the security forces and activists, what were being called comrades, often clashed. I mean, so the sort of violent headline events all stopped dead, really, in mid-June 1986. I had been running around with these guys for several weeks when that happened, and I saw their jobs just really change. We kept going out, but it did get harder. I mean, a lot of the townships and the Bantustans were sealed off to all non-residents, much less whites, much less white foreigners like me.
Even without emergency regulations, whites never cover black territories and never travel with black reporters. Why is that?
It's probably not true to make such an absolute statement, but it is true that it's very difficult for white reporters to cover the townships, I mean, and the war zone, the black townships and the Bantustans, the rural black areas, because, well, several reasons. I mean, for a start, there are very few, if any, white reporters who speak the six or seven languages that are essential for getting around in those places. They don't know the territories themselves, and there aren't many street names or house numbers to help you. They don't know black society, black politics. You know, it's quite complex, and there aren't a lot of roadmaps available to that either. And finally, it's quite dangerous, at least while I was doing the reporting for this story, excuse me, in 1986. The moving in the township, for a white in the townships, it was really not possible to work much. The people's first assumption about any stranger, particularly a white stranger, would be that he worked for the system, as they say, you know, that is the police. and a black and a white traveling in a car together. Well, that's the immediate assumption that that would be the police. And so,
is that because that's how police travel, black and white?
Often they do, yes.
Mm. You were also afraid to carry maps.
Yeah, on occasion, I wanted to bring a map to figure out where I was, and the reporters I was traveling with would say, no, that'll just give us away.
Why would that give you away?
I think that happened particularly in a Bantustan called Kwan Dabele, where the entire area, which was, it's actually supposedly a country. It's a very small, impoverished, and sort of non-viable country, but it's a big area. And it had been completely sealed off, and basically it's 500,000 residents have been placed under house arrest. But we'd gone out there to try and find out what was happening. There was a lot of fighting going on. So we had a couple of different cover stories we were going to try out on any troops or police that stopped us. Suddenly I was going to be an anthropologist, and the other reporters were going to be my assistants, that kind of thing. And I guess the reporters I was with just reckoned that a map would give us away, that we weren't really what we said we were.
Did you ever need to use the cover story?
No, fortunately that day we never got stopped.
Mm-hmm. My guest is William Finnegan, who writes for The New Yorker magazine, and his new book, Dateline Soweto, is about his travels with black South African reporters. Now, black reporters aren't always trusted by black South Africans from the way you describe it. Why is there so much suspicion that blacks might have of black reporters?
Well, I wouldn't say that it's specifically suspicion of black reporters. I think you can speak of a sort of widespread disenchantment with the press. There have been incidents where the police disguise themselves as reporters, as TV crews, what have you, so as to infiltrate political meetings and move around in the townships. I think that the feeling about the mainstream press has got steadily worse, though, in the townships for several years, that is the mainstream South African press, that it's really failed to convey what's going on in the townships. The black reporters I was traveling with, most of them work for a paper called the Johannesburg Star, which is the largest daily paper in the country, a big white liberal daily. And that sector of the press, which is really the dominant sector, the white liberal English language press, has particularly, I think, let down people in its coverage of the conflict. And the black reporters had trouble with the stories they were bringing out of the townships. They had trouble often convincing their editors, white editors, that the stories were true and to run the stories.
I got the impression from your book that some of the black journalists are forced to decide whether they want to be journalists first or activists first, and it's a difficult decision.
Yeah, there's a lot of tension over that distinction. I mean, there's obviously a distinction that needs to be made. But the sort of thing that editors will say when rejecting stories, you're not objective enough, that kind of thing, is really problematic, to say the least, in a situation like that. I mean, what the black reporters will say is, well, objectivity is, reality as the editors see it, and very little more. They'll also say things like, no, we're not political activists in what we write, but then, of course, white journalists can vote, and we can't vote. Most of the journalists I was with were really pretty clear about the idea that in their situation, really the only journalism worth doing is a sort of crusading journalism, that will advance the freedom struggle.
One of the reporters you were traveling with suggested that you all try to commit as much to memory as possible. Is that because if your notebook is found, your sources could be tracked down and harassed?
Yes, that was often a consideration. Also, in some situations that you just don't want, like not having a map on, you just don't want to have notes. Some of these guys used to, besides trying to commit as much as they could to memory, would end up sort of scribbling on odd pieces of paper and stuffing these little scraps of paper in their socks. Or there's one guy, John Quilani, whom I travel with quite a lot, he used to take the cigarettes and the foil out of the cigarette box he carried and write his notes on the inside of the box and then stuff the cigarettes and the foil back in, that kind of thing. Another consideration, though, I mean, a couple of times I asked people, why aren't you taking notes? And they said, well, you know, we want to be able to get out of here and not have our notes seized. Also, I had reporters tell me, well, this is all very interesting, but the editor, this sort of thing these people are saying, the editors won't accept. They'll say, this is too hot, this is too heavy, you know, this is inflammatory. They really don't want to know, the reporters would say, what people are saying in the townships.
The black reporters were able to get stories, and traveling with them, you were able to get stories that a lot of the other press didn't have access to. One of the stories that you were there to cover is the story of Quandabele, which is a self-governing black state, Abandistan. And the South African government wanted to give them independence, and Quandabele didn't want independence. That's a little bit hard, I think, for people outside of South Africa to understand. Maybe you can explain that a little bit based on what you learned covering this story.
Well, the sort of grand plan for the denationalization of black South Africans was, and I mean in some quarters still is, that is some quarters in Pretoria, to create these 10 separate sort of tribal states to which all black South Africans would be assigned, you know, according to where they were born or what language their father spoke or what have you. Often these were places that the people involved had never seen. And they were carved out of the poorest rural areas in South Africa and altogether comprised 13% of the land. And, you know, 72% of the people were to be assigned citizenship in these various areas, thereby losing their South African citizenship and thereby finishing the argument, it was hoped, in Pretoria about black political rights in South Africa because there wouldn't be any black South Africans. Now, this was the grand plan developed in the 50s and the 60s. And four or five of those Bantustans, as they came to be called, sometimes now called homelands, have taken independence and are these ostensibly independent states. You know, there's quite a political struggle in these places over this issue, people not wanting to lose their South African citizenship and participate in this blatantly fraudulent scheme. But Quandabele, the most recent one, the most recent Bantustan to be confronted with this choice, has balked, I think, successfully. I mean, I think you won't see another Bantustan take independence. I hope I'm not wrong, but there was a lot of fighting going on in Quandabele. I mean, there's a small clique of politicians and businessmen and their hirelings who stand to profit from independence, I mean, who are going to be given monopolies in various areas, and that group was willing to accept independence, but there was a huge movement of students, workers, civil servants, teachers against independence, and so there was a lot of fighting out there on the subject and over the issue, and we went out there to try and see some of it.
I think one of the issues that you came to understand a little bit better because of traveling with black reporters through black townships was why there is black-on-black violence in parts of South Africa.
Sure. I mean, in a place like Quandabele, I mean, just about everybody fighting is black. Well, I shouldn't say that. There were white soldiers, both working as advisors to some of the black forces and involved in the fighting. And there were some black police commanders also. I mean, excuse me, white police commanders also involved. But the, you know, South Africa is a fairly complex society. I mean, a fairly diverse society at this point. There is this huge fundamental conflict between settlers and indigenous people, but enough of the conflict is spun off into different sectors, and frankly, whites have the means to have a lot of other people doing the physical fighting for them. I mean, they can pay people drawn from the huge pool of marginalized proletariat, so to speak, in South Africa. I mean, people who don't have anything and for a little money will do most anything. And so you end up with police-backed vigilantes, different sort of groups, very, very locally oriented who are battling other local groups over resources. That's a sort of primary strategy of apartheid, I guess you could say.
Well, the impression I got was that sometimes the South African government will invest power in a group of blacks that are clearly thugs, and people will fight them for that power because they rule very unfairly.
Right. It's the basic divide and rule approach to administration, where you have very scant resources, you know, of land or water or business licenses or what have you, just very scant resources. You put a small, ruthless clique in charge of those resources and let everyone else exhaust themselves trying to wrest that control away. And in fact, the sort of tribal conflict that the South African government is very fond of using, this idea anyway, as a reason why majority rule can't work in South Africa, that is, all the so-called tribes in the country will fall out among each other, is the evidence for that kind of scenario is often drawn from small-scale ethnic conflicts you see in small areas in South Africa that, in fact, if you look closely at them, you will find have been very much created from above. That is, people have been divided along ethnic lines or pseudo-ethnic lines. One group's been given access to this land or whatever, or these jobs, and the group next to it is forced to oppose that group to get anything for itself. And so you have this sort of imposition from above of a structure that ends up looking like ethnic conflict from below, but is in fact not.
Well, I want to talk with you more about the press in South Africa, but first we're going to take a short break. William Finnegan is my guest. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine, and he's written two books about his experiences in South Africa. His latest, Dateline Soweto, tells of his travels through the black townships with a group of black South African reporters under a highly restrictive press ban. His earlier book, Crossing the Line, chronicles his experiences as a teacher in Cape Town in 1980. We'll be back after the short break. This is Fresh Air. William Finnegan is my guest, and we're talking about the South African press. You were just talking about some of the stories that black South African journalists can get in South Africa. Once they get back with a story that has a different perspective than, say, any of the white journalists have put on it, how likely are they to see that story printed in full and given good coverage in a white-run liberal South African paper? Well, like the Johannesburg Star, which is the paper that the reporters who you worked with write for.
Yeah. Well, at the Star, there were about 50 reporters while I was around. Six or seven of them were black, and the blacks were very much assigned to the townships. That was their beat. But the paper actually put out separate editions for blacks and whites. The black edition was called the Africa Edition. And, I mean, it was this sort of same paper with a number of stories transposed, you know, stories that were assumed to be of interest to black readers, substituting for stories assumed to be mainly of interest to white readers, you know, according to which edition was going out. And a lot of times, what seemed like a big story would only get, you know, brought out of the townships, would only get played in the Africa edition, which had a much smaller press run.
You say that in South Africa it's frequently easier to print opinion than it is to print fact. I guess you could be more outspoken in a column than you can in a reportorial piece where you're actually naming names and talking about how many people were detained or imprisoned.
Yeah, I think in a way that's always true, but it's particularly true under the South African censorship laws, where you are much freer to express opinion than you are to report facts. The ordinary censorship laws, that is, the censorship laws under normal conditions, are quite extensive. There are over 100 laws restricting what you can print. You can't write anything about the activity of the South African military or what goes on inside the prisons. And there are all these areas that you can't cover at all. In fact, a few years ago, one of the major papers started running a picture of a little pair of scissors alongside each part of a story that had been changed or cut to follow the censorship laws, and it was quite startling, the effect. I mean, there were little scissors all over every page of the paper, and that's all, remember, self-censorship. That's being done by the reporters themselves or by the editors or by the lawyers, and this is all under normal conditions, and since mid-1986 there's been a national state of emergency in effect that introduces a whole other range of restrictions on reporting. So all that goes into any consideration about what can be printed as well.
What has the reaction been of the white liberal editors in the opposition papers to the press restrictions that have been in effect since this state of emergency?
Well, it's pretty strong. I mean, they have always been, that is, the editors of the big white papers, quite eloquent in their denunciations of apartheid and in their calls, at least in recent years, for immediate negotiations between the government and the leaders of the black majority. They're also quite good on detention without trial, which is a massive phenomenon in South Africa, unfortunately, and quite good on press freedom. But as for actually defying the laws, taking chances, being hauled into court, that's very, very expensive. And I think that a fair amount of the criticism leveled at them for not taking more chances. This is sort of a consensus black opinion about the mainstream press. I think that's justified.
One of the reporters that you traveled with complained that black reporters are always expected to write in times of crisis stories that are headlined "Black Leaders Appeal for Calm," and he didn't want to do that. Is that typical? I mean, is that literally true that the black reporters are expected to write those stories?
Well, that was just a particular instance that I witnessed when the state of emergency came down, and thousands of people were disappearing into the jail. I mean, into the jails on the day. I was there in the little section of the newsroom where the black reporters worked, which they called the ghetto, when a call came from the editors saying, "We want a story, Black Leaders Appeal for Calm." Sort of a journalistic chestnut in a situation like that. And the reporter I was sitting with, John Quilani, who was the one they wanted to write it, just said, "No, you know, how can they expect us to write that kind of thing when we're under this kind of attack?" And he didn't.
The reporters who you knew are now restricted from covering a lot of stories. Have they come up with ways of getting around that, with circumventing any of the restrictions?
Well, they do. They're supposed to continue filing stories and leaving the question of whether or not the stories can run up to the editors and the paper's lawyers. I think that they must, I mean, a lot of their story itself has dried up. That is, the contacts that they use to find out what is happening in the townships, many of them have been arrested, and many of them are still in jail, and many more have been driven underground. Plus, there's much less going on above ground, so there's less stories to report. And I think that in news, sort of timing is everything. And when you know that a story, even though it's good, is not going to run, at least not run right away, I mean, until the lawyers have gone through it with a fine-tooth comb, I think that's got to affect your sort of zest for the job.
Do you think that the press ban in South Africa is accomplishing what the white government wants it to accomplish?
I think that internationally, yes. It's been quite a success. That is, it used to be that you could find out more about what was happening in South Africa at some levels and in some areas by reading the international press than you could by reading the South African press. For instance, when South Africa invaded Angola in 1975, you could read all about it for months in the international press, while most South Africans had no idea that their army had even gone into Angola. There are many, many examples of that kind of thing. But with the new press restrictions over the past couple of years, the foreign press is virtually as shackled as the national press. And that has really affected coverage, of course. But as for whether people could get more out than they do, I'm not sure. I think it's more a question of perspective. I mean, definitely the foreign news organizations in South Africa decline to risk their presence in the country over one story, and that's cumulative. I mean, you get more and more stories shelved because they seem to get close to the regulations or transgress them. But even more, it's just this problem of perspective. I mean, reporting in a way that will convey the black perspective, if one can speak of a black perspective in a country where there are 25 million black people, on events, you know, where you just do the reporting basically in the townships and in the Bantustans, trying to look at the issues of the day from that angle. That's what the government really doesn't want, and that's what they really crack down on. And that's not anywhere in the laws, but you can see journalists, foreign reporters who are kicked out, and the only sin you can find is that they really did that kind of digging and produced a story that emphasized black experience somehow. That's what's really suffered, because that kind of reporting has gotten harder and harder to do.
You've gone to South Africa twice, once to teach and once to follow black journalists on their stories. What's the experience like for you being white in South Africa? I would think that there's this constant desire to want to explain yourself, to want to separate yourself from the whites who support white rule, to constantly declare where you stand.
It's funny. That really hasn't been very true for me. I think that the fact that I was not South African really helped when I was teaching in a black high school in Cape Town. I had much less suspicion to overcome being American. People gave me more benefit of the doubt, I think. That is, my colleagues and my students in the community. But it's surprising how little, actually, I felt that on this more recent trip, spending time with the black reporters, the fact that I lived in South Africa before was actually very helpful. That is, I think probably my questions were a little less stupid than they might have been, a little less elementary, and more than that, they could just make certain assumptions about what I knew, and also the general assumption that I wouldn't be running around with them if I wasn't sympathetic somehow to what it is they're trying to do.
Mm-hmm. William Finnegan, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
William Finnegan's new book is titled Dateline Soweto, Travels with Black South African Reporters. He's also the author of Crossing the Line, A Year in the Land of Apartheid. Both are published by Harper & Row. Finnegan is a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.